Green Scene on The Pat Kenny Show. Sponsored by ESB. Working towards a brighter energy future. ESB.ie.
Now, Texas and the disaster that their electricity grid endured last week should be a salutary lesson to all of those who run electricity grids. How resilient is ours? Well, Professor Brian O'Gallagher is Director of MARAI, the SFI Research Centre for Energy, Climate and Marine, and he's on the line. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, Texas had, if you'll pardon the pun, the kind of perfect storm. Because they had a grid that wasn't connected to the federal grid, and they had a number of probably predictable failures.
Correct. Yes, and they had a very unexpected cold spell that they really weren't anticipating. So they were very badly hit, and they had very difficult circumstances to deal with. And I suppose it does give us pause, as you mentioned, to reflect on where we are here in Ireland. And a few weeks ago, I spoke about some of our analysis looking at 2030 and trying to anticipate what they experienced in Germany in early 2017, an extended period of cold and low wind, because that's a real challenge for systems that have, as we have, a high amount of wind energy and higher ambitions for wind energy. We got a small flavour of that in the first 2 weeks of January here because we had very cold weather combined with low levels of wind. It wasn't for an extended period, but over that first 2 weeks, we did have significant variation. And wind energy at one stage on January the 6th provided just 6% of our electricity, and then it went up to 60% on January 11th. So our system has to cope with significant fluctuations. And mostly we don't see that. We don't see the activity behind the scenes. But what we do, and we're not even, we take it for granted. When we flick the switch on, we expect the electricity to be there. But the key part of our system resilience is the ability of our natural gas power plants to compensate and to be there when the wind isn't, and to be able to be turned down when the wind is there. And we also have good interconnection, increasing amounts of interconnection. So on that day on January 6th, 67% of our electricity came from natural gas. And when we had lots of wind, then we could turn it down to 24%. So that ability to be able to crank up and down the natural gas power plants is a very important but largely invisible part of our energy system resilience. We did have another problem, of course, because it was cold. So people also needed gas for heating. And this, again, was similar, but not at the same scale as the issues in Texas. And the gas system was able to cope with this increasing heating demand. So we've got very resilient electricity systems and very resilient gas systems. But we shouldn't take them for granted. I mean, we really need to have a strong focus on energy security and energy system resilience going forward.
One of the things we're trying to do, we're trying to get micro generation where people will, in their own homes or on the roofs of office blocks or schools or whatever, will be collecting solar power. On farms, I cannot see any reason why there couldn't be small scale windmills that would help to generate power, which could mean that farmers didn't have to use electricity from the grid, and we have to find ways of feeding surpluses into the grid and pricing structures and so on to make it all work. But one thing we don't have, with one singular exception, is energy storage. We have Thurlough Hill, which is the pumped storage idea that the ESB exploited decades ago, where, you know, surplus power is used to pump water up a hill and then it comes down through a hydroelectric generator on the way back down when you need a surge. Is there any plan to, you know, build massive batteries, for example, that would store excess wind and solar power?
Well, this is part of the solution, certainly. There are many parts of the solution. There's higher interconnection. There's having gas power at the ready. There's battery storage. There's the production of hydrogen. There's pumped hydro. There are many different options. And there's also the option of smart demand, so that things like refrigeration and electric vehicles, being able to time when they're actually charging, and also in the case of electric vehicles potentially drawing charge from them at certain times. And we do have also small and micro-scale batteries. So, for example, one of the projects down in the Dingle Peninsula, where there's an exploration, if you like, in electrification, part of what's happening there is solar panels on the roof, as you mentioned, but also with batteries there as well, and testing out how they integrate with the network and how also the farmers and the other people using those systems get on with them as well. So getting that experience, the lived experience, as well as the technical information.
All right. So it's good to know that people in AirGrid are, you know, thinking and designing and, you know, future proofing our grid in the event of extreme weather events. Obviously, if the power lines come down and you've got a certain amount of energy independence, electricity independence, it would you know, help them out enormously in terms of the pressure to get people back on the grid. Now, the other question today is, when should we actually ban the burning of solid fuels in our homes? If you want to build a new house, there's no fireplace.
Yes. So with new houses, it's a clear-cut situation. The building regulations are very strong now on building energy performance. So effectively, this is a question for the existing housing stock, of which we have, of course, many houses. And the consultation underway is to seeking views on how to regulate the use of solid fuels. So we do already have a ban on smoky coal in most places, and that will extend nationally. So currently, all major cities and towns in excess of 10,000 residents are covered by smoky coal bans. So that's going to be extended. So the government is doing a consultation at the moment to discuss the other fuels, the other solid fuels, so peat, wood. Yeah. And we spoke about these all previously on this slot in terms of the contribution to air pollution. So we have about 1,300 deaths per annum associated with air pollution. But one of the things we have to watch for is unintended consequences, potential unintended consequences, because while air pollution is killing people, unfortunately, so too is fuel poverty. And we don't have great data from this. We have data from 2015, and it's an estimate that cold weather and fuel poverty is estimated to have caused 2,800 deaths in the year 2015, and that's on an all-island basis, so north and south.
So you might save 1,500 people from dying from pollution, and then you kill 2,800 people who are cold. So that's the dilemma. We have to leave it there, Brian. And also, I know that we'll get texts from people living halfway up a mountain, burning turf and saying, I'm not polluting anybody. The pollution is long gone by the time it hits the next household. But that's perhaps for another day. Brian O'Gallagher, Director of MARAI, the SFI Research Centre for Energy, Climate and the Marine. Thank you very much for joining us. And it's with thanks to the ESB and IIEA Rethink Energy Lecture Series. You can check it all out at IIEA.com.